to start, I'd like to get your perspective on this whole parallel I'm drawing between championship coaches and leaders of high performance business teams. But before you answer that, let me give you a little bit of background. Also, I've downloaded your current book. I've downloaded the decision-making book, which I'm reading that one a lot deeper right now because I think it's more pertinent to what I'm trying to do here. Watched a lot of your videos, subscribed, you know, in the last week since I got introduced. I'm a student now, but can you give me what your perspectives are on this parallel that I'm drawing between championship coaches and business leaders?
Yeah, the first thing to parallel is a desire that you must be what you can be. A lot of times as leaders, we look specifically on the capabilities of what they can do as a teacher, mentor, or a coach. And as a leader, we need to be truly an intelligent follower. And the proof of being an intelligent follower is the ability to have a desire that we must be what we can be ourselves. Because if we're going to teach someone, in other words, be able and capable of knowing something so well that we can have the patience, the annoying capability of being repetitive and honest enough to help teach someone what we know. It's not a one-time, and this is one of the difficulties in secular education in America, is we think we can just say something one time and we absorb it, know it, can execute on it. And it's not true. The great coaches are annoying. They're honest and repetitive. And utilize that desire that they have to be what they must be to inspire other people to have the desire that they must be what they can be. The second thing beyond the teacher is the mentor. You know, I think in order to be a great leader that we actually have to know where and be where somebody wants to be. So if you look at the great coaches, as well as great leaders, they actually had to be able to walk the walk. They need to know the plays. They had to have had the losses themselves. Right. And I think that's really important. The interesting thing is the word coach, because I believe that as a great coach in that aspect and a great leader in the business organization, what's often overlooked is a capability that doesn't have to have success tied to it. Meaning to bring the best out of other people. And that's the interesting one where I like to play the most is that, look, everyone has their life experiences. You know, I can have a 19-year-old life coach mentor me on social media, and they know enough about social media that they could show me the steps, and they might be patient and enough of an intelligent follower to teach me how to do social media at 19. Right. But do they have the capability of bringing the best out of me? And when we look at the great coaches, you know, Tiger Woods has a coach. I doubt, knowing his coach, that he is a better golfer or, you know, in any way in that respect, but he brings the best out of Tiger Woods. And so I think understanding these parallels, number one, the desire that you must be what you can be. You must be a great teacher, mentor, and coach to be a great leader, and what we formally say is a championship coach, a winning coach. And then we can move into the other aspects of identifying skills, knowledge, and desires of each individual. There's an old saying, I'm chairman of Napoleon Hill Institute, and one of the things that drives me crazy is they say, oh, you're the aggregate of the five people that you spend the most time with. Well, I think about my wife who raised four children in very close to age ranges. And I think to myself, my wife is one of the most dynamic, intelligent, intuitive, and inspirational individuals who saved my life. And that's how highly I think of her. Mm-hmm. She is not the aggregate of the five people she spent the most time with.
With the four kids and you.
Exactly. But what I think is interesting about the great championship coach and a business leader is they understand teams, but not the aggregate of a team. They understand the positions of a team and the roles within the team that people play, so that everybody, I choose subject matter, topic, or expertise teams, and then I get buy-in to what position they're playing on the team and how they coordinate and collaborate with the other people. And the real coordination and collaboration, in my opinion, in both respects, as a championship coach or a business leader, is that every person is playing their position, but the the other positions are pulling up a seat next to them, and they're pulling up a seat next to them. Right. So everyone's elevating each other in this cohesive, collaborative unit. And I find that the great coaches are these team coaches that know not only subject matter, topics, and expertise, but where people's strengths and weaknesses are, and not only putting them in the right position on the team, but more importantly, with a mindset of you're pulling a chair up next to you and everyone else is pulling up a chair next to them.
Wow. Great stuff. Thank you. One thing you mentioned earlier in that conversation was the dogmatic, you know, discipline, let's say, of a leader to say the same message over and over. It's one of the things that I learned early in business when I had a CEO come in from P&G, basically. And, you know, I'd go to different meetings and I'd see media reports and they'd always be saying the same pieces. And I'm like, wow, how to continue to say that. And so I had to get comfortable with that myself as a leader. But the way I'm trying to teach it in my MBA class, which I'd be interested in your perspectives, I say, look, I'm talking about media. There's a bunch of research. I'm a marketing person by trade first, but before we went into general management. But there's a bunch of research out that says that somebody must see a marketing message 5 to 7 times on average before they ingrains into them, and that they pay attention and reflect or act on it if they desire. And so I tell them in the class, and as leaders, you have to be comfortable saying the same thing multiple times, maybe in different ways, before it really sticks with people. Do you agree with that kind of assessment? Or?
Oh, 100% agree. I think it even goes further, which to me, you know, I believe in the consistent, persistent pursuit of a potential, but I think it goes even further to an emotional aspect of human beings. And it stems from when we were children as proof. You know, I speak around the world. I say the same things a lot. And it's difficult to do when you're still learning yourself and trying to be creative and exciting. But the basics are so important. Why? You know, I was always afraid on the stage, don't tell the gratitude story again. Don't tell the coat, the jacket story about your dad. They've already heard it. It doesn't matter. You know, how many people went to SoFi Stadium when the Rolling Stones were there? And if they didn't play Satisfaction, they would have left disappointed. When I was a little boy, if you didn't read me Brown Bear every night by Eric Carle, right, then I would be disappointed. So it's more than just elevating the awareness through repetition. It's actually human nature loves repetition.
Wow, that's really good. They
feel comfortable when they go to the same restaurant. They feel comfortable when they hear the same thing. So you're actually not only logically elevating the awareness to your brand, but you're actually creating an emotional connection, and people buy an emotion for logical reasons.
And that's one of the biggest things with teams. We bring it back to teams, which is, and I've done a lot of research and I've studied coaches and coaching for years. I go to practices. I've been to Lakers practices. I've been to Rams practices. I've been to practices of all championship teams, and I love to go and just watch the coach. And what the key, though, and as I'm speaking to them, is about building trust. And I think what you're just talking about, too, is there's some familiar. If you get familiar, you build trust within your team as a leader potentially also. Is that correct?
Yeah, very much so. And I think there's another aspect is, and I'd be happy to introduce you to a guy named Mike Tannenbaum, who I went to law school with. He's on ESPN. He runs the 33rd team, which has all the greatest coaches, Belichick, and all those guys in the 33rd team. But, you know, there's an interesting philosophy I have about coaches and leaders. The great coaches win on even though there's bad calls and injuries. And the great leaders in a business, they win even though there's bad calls and injuries. And, you know, it's a given to the great coaches. Cause I'm like you, I study the coaches, Saban, and, you know, one of my favorites. And of course, Belichick, another favorite, you know, even Bochy, who won the World Series late in his life, and Jack McKeon, who later on in his life, what made those guys great is they won even though there was bad calls and injuries. And in business, if you look at the leaders today, the Jobs, the Gates, the Musk, the Bezos, you know, and you study like Walter Isaacson, and who goes into great detail, extraordinary researcher and interviewer, these books that he writes about Einstein and Franklin. I mean, the richness. But what it tells me is all these guys are winning. And yes, they have the same problems, right? They have injuries and they have bad calls, but they somehow are champions.
Yeah, I have a phrase I try to share with my teams. It's always been the tougher the battle, the sweeter the victory. Now, I have no idea who I took that phrase from, and I should be giving them credit. But I say, so that it's tough when you're in the valley to realize that. But you, if you ask anyone what their best victory was, they don't say, we were up by 12 in the first quarter, we're up by 25 in the second half, and we cruised to a great victory. That's not the greatest victory by anybody. It's when they fought through something, right?
I tell people, don't waste the struggle. Don't waste the struggle.
Okay, if I use that one, I'll try to remember to give you credit. let me go back to something, because I'm really very, very focused on first and second level business managers, people who are great at their job, whether they're an engineer or a marketing person or operations person, and they get that promotion. And all of a sudden, wow, now I'm leading the team. And the people who work for me are doing the work, but I'm supposed to be, you know, leading them and setting goals and creating culture. And oftentimes, as I deal with these individuals, they have a challenge with confidence as a first or even a second level leader. Can you share any tips that either you can recall or you've developed over time to help these people get confidence to lead a team when they're doing it for the first time?
So it's interesting because I deal with a lot of those first and second level managers and leaders. And I always talk in the realm of number one, value, because repetition of being able to communicate value brings confidence and comfortability and a new form of leadership. But also a methodology to provide value is to make sure as a new leader that we're asking questions and giving suggestions, not dictating what we know or don't know. And so the way I describe it to young leaders or first time or second time level leaders is, number one, understand how value is derived as a leader. When we can understand as a leader, what do you like? What don't you like? What works? What doesn't work for you?
And of the people who work for them.
For them, right? And above them. So I always say, find out what people like and they don't like, what's working and what's not working, and then find out what they know and what they don't know. Now, you can ask questions or give suggestions saying, would it help you if I gave you more of what you liked or took away what you didn't like? Would it help you if I gave you more of what's working or took away what's not working? Or would it help you if I gave you more of what you know or take away what you don't know? And when I give a very simple framework of being a leader, of providing value, and you're new at it, it gives you some confidence of, wait, hold on a second, this is easy. I can be a great leader by giving people more of what they like, what's working and what they know, and taking away what they don't like, what's not working, what they don't know. And I do it through questions and suggestions.
And, yeah, that's a terrific framework.
And gives them that confidence to be and grow into leadership. And then the final step too is, you know, humility. And this took me so many years. I wish somebody would have slapped me in the face before I lost $100 million and gave me the best piece of advice for any young leader or first or second level leader. Ask for help.
Oh, right.
Holy shit. Right. Oh my God. Right. Like, that's the biggest problem. When you get that elevated role, you think, if I ask for help, they're going to know I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely.
People aren't going to trust. It's the exact opposite. You know, humility is the combination of being human and tranquil. And tranquility as a human being is an admired characteristic of a leader. And we trust a vulnerable leader. We trust a tranquil, humble leader. And the best way to illustrate the humility, plus to be an intelligent follower, which is a key aspect of being a leader, is to ask for help.
I think what generally in business, people step into those roles and they hear that and it's almost counter logical until you hear it explained as well as you just did. You say, like, well, they just elevated me to a vice president role, so I'm supposed to lead and charge and tell people everything they need to know on day one. And it's exactly the opposite, right?
Exactly.
But that's a great framework about the like, don't like, because I've heard about asking questions. And as I've interviewed these championship coaches have won 17 national championships and, you know, NBA championships. And you talk to them about how they first got the confidence to go there. And they say, well, I knew I didn't know everything at the beginning. And I asked my players, what do you think? And I asked the other coaches, what do they think? And I asked questions, not as eloquent as you just talked about with the likes and don't likes and what do you want more of and less is fantastic. Thank you. I guess I have another question about you. You talked a lot about in the past about what I've written down as intentional decisions. And maybe those are my words. Maybe I've captured them correctly. But what are some keys leaders can share with their team to help them make better intentional decisions? Like, so if they're stepped up, I can ask questions, I can do this, but can I also help them make better intentional decisions?
Well, first of all, understanding that there's multiple solutions to a problem. That helps us immediately understand. And also that the problems are inherently have the solution. There's always just a lapse of time between a problem and a solution. And so to start off to make intentional decisions, we have to put ourselves in an even or an easy playing field of, first of all, there's tons of different solutions to this problem.
Right.
The solution already exists. It's just a lapse of time before I figure this out. So now we take the what seemingly seems to be impossible, resistance creates overwhelmed and procrastination, the two things that inhibit us from making a decision. Now, the key component of understanding decision-making is understanding what's important to us according to the circumstances of the day. So I train people to, one, have non-negotiable behaviors that says, regardless of the circumstances of the day, I'm going to spend a minimum of time sleeping with my family, finance, faith, health, studying time and relativity. Now, with the rest of my time, I'm going to have what's called negotiable behavior, which is prioritized behavior according to the circumstances. Now, circumstances are going to throw you off of the track if you don't already know a divine direction for the day. What's important for me today? See, once I know what's important to me today, personally, experientially, giving wise and receiving wise, then I can go ahead and pre-prioritize my day by charting out my day. I can then prioritize it according to the circumstances, because I promise you, when you come up with a pre-prioritization plan, a well-developed plan, God will laugh at you, and he certainly will laugh at you. And yes. I have to remind myself when God's laughing at me that the only certainty of today and tomorrow is I get 24 hours. It's guaranteed. Right. Everything else is uncertain. That's why it's circumstantial. So therefore, my job is to say, okay, remind myself what's important today. I'm now going to reprioritize my day according to what's important and according to the actual reality of the day, the circumstances. I know that I'm going to continue to grow because I already took care of the non-negotiable behaviors of sleep, health, family, finance, faith, relativity, and time study. So for the rest of the day, I'm just getting better at practicing prioritization of what's important to me. And then, of course, in I think it was what Eisenhower's matrix of making sure you don't get fooled by urgency, right? Urgency is a subset of importance. But I think most people don't make decisions because they think there's only one solution. They don't realize the solution already exists. They don't realize it's just a lapse of time between the problem and solution. And then furthermore, they don't know what's important to them in the day to start, so that when circumstances or God laughs at you, they don't have a clue how to reprioritize because they have no North Star. I call it a divine direction. If you know what's important to you, your divine direction can have plenty of divine detours. Your actual detours end up indicating you got a better place to be. And now faith even plays a more integral part in decision-making. And then the most, I think for me, valuable part of this process is that if you as an entrepreneur or a leader can work with divine time, because we as leaders, business leaders, we're extremely obsessive and goal-oriented. We attach our emotions to the goal, and we're always saying, I'll be happy when I hit my number. I'll be happy when I sell this many razors. You know, I'll be happy Hot Wheels is the number one brand in the world. No, you should be saying Hot Wheels is going to be the number one brand in the world for the sake of making kids happy. I'm going to say, we're going to sell more scooters because for the sake of it, more happy kids. So I always change instead of I'll be happy when to for the sake of what.
Yeah, that's excellent. Yeah. And we do. I mean, when we do well, I think I agree with you. We do that when I come into brands, I often try to figure out what their mission and purpose is as the brand. And people say, well, we make, you know, metal scooters. Like, no. We build a fabric that builds camaraderie between friends and family. Like, family rides together, friends ride together. That's what we do. It's just, yeah. This is a piece of metal that does that. So I agree. I know I've got limited time. I want to ask, I'm going to jump to this one because I want to be sensitive to your time. I know you have a goal of this inspiring 1 billion people to be happy.
Over 1 billion. Don't limit.
Sorry, over. Okay, sorry, yeah, over. Thank you for the correction. And assume you've spoken to several behavioral scientists and research experts, et cetera. And I just wanted to, you know, extend the offer. I happen to know two professors who have written books on happiness. And if that is of any interest to you at any point, I'm happy to make those connections or send you their names or make a warm introduction, of course.
I'd love to interview them and you, and I'd love to come up there and speak at LMU again. I worked with Jerome Carter, one of the entrepreneurial professors there for years, in prisons as well with him. He's a great guy.
Great. So, Mike, I think I have two last questions.
Okay, perfect.
The last two questions are, and they're short, but the first one is, are there any coaches you would recommend I speak to on this topic? Obviously.
Yeah, Mike Tannenbaum, and then he'll introduce you to all the greatest coaches of all time.
So if I ask from my mission for the students, if you could make that introduction, that'd be fantastic.
Mike is a great resource for you.
Great. Second one. It's a weird one to ask, but whenever someone gives to me like this, I want to give back. And so are there any ways I might be able to help you, your family, your organization in any way, shape, or form? I offer it today. I offer it a week from now. I will offer it 6 years from today.
Well, one, I'd love to come up there and speak to the kids. Two, I'd love for you to come to SoFi Stadium where my office and studio are and maybe participate and teach. We'll interview you and have a Q&A session. I do a VIP dinner up there.
Great.
Once a month we're at SoFi. My office is there doing that. And then I have a TV show. If you ever want to come out to film for Apple TV, office hours, do a spotlight on you in your journey, we'd love to do that as well.
Fantastic. That's fantastic. Is there anything I forgot? Are there any last things that you would like to share with this audience?
Share to ask for help was one. You know, my favorite quote that keeps resonating with me my whole life, from the time I lost over 100 million, made it back, to even recently with my mom passing, that for me, you're either humble or you're about to be. And for those people that have had great success in their life and have great capabilities like you, and I will self-impose that on myself. One of the dangers is we forget that you're either humble or you're about to be. And I try to spend minutes and moments outside of humility. That's it, just minutes and moments. But the more humble I am in the respect of asking for help, to be of service, to live in kindness, not just for today, but being kind to my future self by just simply doing good deeds, even when they may, there's no small good deed. I want to remind, think about this, the power of a good deed. If I could teach everyone on earth one simple thing, to pick up any piece of trash they ever see and put it in its appropriate place, do you know what impact that would have on the earth? It would have an incredible impact on our food, on our air, on our water. If everybody on earth did a simple deed by when they saw a piece of trash, they put it into the appropriate place. And so there are no small deeds. And I just want to encourage everyone to be kind, not only to themselves today, to others, but to their future self, and really look to do good.
Well, you've done a big deed today. And I will carry on the small deed. I'll pick up one piece of trash in your honor in the next day or two, and I will perpetuate your inspirational insights that you've shared with me today with my class, and with many others, I'm sure. And I'm going to take you up on your offer to come by and see you at SoFi. And in any way I can help your mission.
For your class. I'll bring everybody a book when I come to visit your class as well.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much for your time today. Thanks, David.
You got it. Thank you.